So good afternoon. I'm Leslie McCartney. Today is Tuesday, April the 16th, 2019. We're in the National Park Service offices in Nome, Alaska, and I'm here with Jacob Barton. Thank you very much for coming in. And Katie Cullen, thank you. Could you both introduce yourselves just so we can have it on the record?
Sure. My name is Katie Cullen. I'm the Interpretation and Education Program Manager at Bering Lambridge National Preserve in headquartered in Nome, Alaska.
I'm Jacob Martin, the Tribal Resource Director at the Nome Eskimo Community, the Tribe for Nome, Alaska.
Great. So thanks, Jacob, for coming in. We really appreciate it. And we're first going to just do a little bit of biographical information, if that's okay. So can you tell me where you were born?
I was born here in Nome.
And so your parents were from here, too?
Yep. Both my parents were born and mostly raised here. They had a little bit of outside experience outside of Nome, but they both ended up back here, and so.
So both sets of grandparents are from here too?
Yes, my grandparents ended up living here, but on my mother's side, they were from King Island. So I have heritage from King Island and furthermore in that area from both.
And what were the names of your grandparents?
On my mother's side, my grandpa was John Taxick. And my grandma was Lucy Koyuk.
Okay. And that was on your mom's side?
Yes.
And on your dad's side?
And on my dad's side, let's see, I don't quite recall this one. There's an extensive family tree.
Mm-hmm. And then your parents' names?
Arthur Martin, also known as Guy Martin. And my mother is Blue, also known as, or Mildred Martin, also known as Blue Martin.
Okay. So you went to school here in Nome?
Yep. I went to the elementary and the junior and senior high school. Graduated in 2012. I attended two summers of summer college, pre-college education, and I also attended a year in Fairbanks.
Oh, did you?
UAF. And then I came back to Nome and found employment, stayed, and had a family.
So what did you study at Fairbanks?
I think the main emphasis out of everything was geology and geologic engineering.
So when you came back to Nome in which year?
I came back in the summer of 2013.
Okay, and then what employment did you find?
I actually was an intern for Sitnisok Native Corporation throughout their administration and their land department.
And so how did you transition to where you are now?
I worked a few years at Sitnisok, filling in different roles that they needed. And when I saw the opportunity to work as a subsistence specialist in early 2015, I took it and started in May of 2015. And within a year and a half, I filled in the role of Tribal Resource Director at Nome Eskimo.
Wow. So did you and your family live some of your subsistence lifetime?
Absolutely. I actually grew up with my family would visit my aunt and uncle who lived in Koyuk. And we would go boating in the spring and summer, and I remember spending a winter or two there. And coming back to Nome, after my aunt and uncle moved here, we started subsisting more so here, fishing, and the same activities we conducted in Koyuk.
And you still practice today, subsistence?
Yeah, we still, usually I'm out there spring hunting this time of the year, but I have work to do and an injury, so, mm-hmm. And I'm, but usually there is, spring subsistence hunt, summer fishing, fall moose, caribou, winter, and kind of winter's working and some caribou hunting available.
So tell us more about your actual job then, what you're responsible for.
So as the Tribal Resource Director, my main source of funding comes from the EPA, Indian General Assistance Program, in which I oversee environmental, different portions of environmental work, of which is water quality baseline data research that we conduct at 7 streams at 8 locations. I also oversee a beach cleanup, as to say, where we have an employee or two going up and down the local beaches here to find any scrap material that washes up, because there are some materials that wash up from historic Nome, any garbage or plastics or disposables that have washed up, and just to keep the areas that are mainly recreated on clean.
Yeah. Have you noticed a greater increase in any of that of the last few years?
I feel like I have seen a slight increase in maybe what would be considered scrap metal, and it just comes up and it's just some rusted old material that's washing up either through the sand or getting washed up on the beach. Historically, there was a site off at East Beach that was considered like a dumping site or waste material, and scrap metals were dumped there. Sometimes you find stuff that might have fallen off someone's dredge or boat, and sometimes it's just a fishing buoy or some rope or anything like that. Sometimes we find things that might have been buried 30, 40 years ago, and that are just washing up in frames of some vehicles or trailers that didn't make it off the beach.
Has the beach receded then?
That's a tough question. In some places, it seems like it is receding, but it also seems like there is a slight deposit here at Nome because of our causeway and port, as we do have that sand being deposited right in front of Nome. And that's considered now Middle Beach between East Beach, which is a huge recreational zone for everyone from kids to people taking walks and their dogs, and West Beach, which was considerably mined out and continuing to be mined out by miners, recreational miners, occupational miners, and also the large vessel dredges you see.
Interesting. Well, as you know, we're here to talk about environmental or climate change that you've maybe seen or experienced over your lifetime or from what you've heard from your parents. So we'll kind of jump into that right now. And you were just saying that you were going to be writing a new...
We were going to update our climate adaptation plan that has there are four tribes based in Nome and their corresponding corporation, village native corporations. And we worked together on that from 2015 to 2017 with our technical writer out of UAF, Alaska Climate Center for Assessment and Policy, Nathan Kettle. And now that the plan was published in 2017, we're going to be following up on different aspects of it or different initiatives that were taken while it was being written.
So what initiatives were in the original? I take it that this was the first adaptation plan that you had?
Yes. From our records, it is the first official adaptation plan. That doesn't mean there have been people who've been planning to adapt to different climate changes or anything that's happened over the years. So I think the main thing that we've seen recently is the sea ice and lack thereof and thinning. This year is the earliest the sea ice has broken up and gone out, and it has come back in and refrozen, but it's also broken up and gone out. It's the earliest on, I believe, our recorded history here, and it happened later on the day of the Nome Golovin race in early March, which we haven't seen it broken off that early, with the Bering Strait and the Bering Sea being ice-free, I believe the earliest in recorded history here in over 90 years of that information.
What's the usual date? If I know every year is different, but normally would it be like in April or...?
I've seen it in April. It's been more so in April in the past few years. But I remember being, when I was younger and extremely younger, I was hunting on shore fast, like ice, until late May. And then it would kind of go near mid to late May. But in the last probably 10 years, it's probably been edging up into April. So,
for this year's spring hunting, I haven't really heard yet kind of how the early ice shifting has kind of impacted things, but I imagine it's been a big impact. I remember hearing around Iditarod time that crab pots were like moving around big time and people were losing crab pots, and like, but I hadn't heard really kind of what was going on with spring hunting.
So,
and how that was changing.
For spring hunting in other locations, I've seen that they're seeing marine mammals migrating now. They've taken their opportunity to go with the ice leaving. And a lot of them are ice-based. They rest on ice flows and that flow north. This last week, it was the first time I noticed people more than one person going out, or more than one vessel, and they were going out, and there were walruses and bearded seal or ugruks and other seals out there that they were harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they were within 30-ish miles, 20 miles is the closest for the walrus that they've seen. But there is some ice as you head east, and that's where it's breaking off, and they're finding those ice flows as they're non-existent here in front of Nome. But I remember in the past, I used to go also east because the ice would stay around there longer into further into May. And that's where I would hunt on the ice looking for seal holes. But as I got older and I acquired a boat, I was able to go out in end of April or mid to end of April. Even though the harbor was frozen, we'd pull our boats up on the ice there and pull it to where if the ice broke off, we knew it wasn't going to drift away. But with that, with the shore fast ice going down west, it would always be thinner, rotten, and probably dangerous to go over. And we would hunt there if it was safe, and we could successfully hunt, not lose anything, and have loss of life of our crew members. So this is it. If you don't have a boat, it's becoming harder and harder. If you don't have a snowmobile, it's also becoming harder because now you can't travel as far on the ice. Mm. So.
Yes, it was on the radio yesterday about seal pups actually coming on shore here.
And that is more of an occurrence happening that since the late 2000s, or even earlier, that there people have noticed more and more seal pups come into shore. Some people know that their moms will leave them to go out and feed, and a lot of the time their moms will abandon them to start their own lives. But a lot of times people see it and they think there's a poor, you know, abandoned animal on the beach when it's resting. It can't swim for days like its mothers, some of its family members. And since there is no ice that it can take refuge on, they come to shore where it's ideally safer for them. But there are now people noticing more seal pups and reporting it.
Just going back to the climate change adaptation plan that you were first involved with, and you said the years went up to 2015 to 2017?
Yeah,
so it's a two-year plan?
Those were the years that they were researching and writing it.
Right.
But it's gone. There were multiple sources of information that led from historical data to recent data from hunters and different workshops and groups.
Okay.
Or groups we've had.
So I'm just interested. So there wasn't an official plan before, but then there was. So what was the impetus of saying we've got to do something, or we have to have a plan in place?
It was to look at what's all happening and how it's changing so that we can figure out what we're going to do or what we want to do, which steps we want to take that would make the most sense, and that we have it documented that this is all happening so that in 5 years, 10 years, we can say we had it written down and these were what we were planning to do, and it's up to us to keep it going, to say this, here's how we're changing and adapting to this, so we have it recorded.
Right. So from that time to this new planning time that you're doing, is there different things that you think you're going to put in for adaptations that you've already noticed? It's a very short period of time.
Yeah. I think just for an example, this last year we've heard that the cold, I believe it's considered like the cold wall that separates the southern from the northern Bering Sea has disappeared. And so is it walleye, pollock, and cod are moving north, and those are commercial fish that are harvested by commercial fisheries. We're up here, we rarely see them, if any, and we haven't heard of any subsistence uses for them yet, or anyone how they're fishing for them. But if they're here, it's been shown that if something's here, we're going to harvest it and utilize it from moose and caribou, and if they have any changing migrations or even reindeer.
Yeah, I heard that they were traveling super far north this past summer, right? The pollock and all the way up into the Beaufort Sea, from what I understood.
Yeah, they were
finding. Amazing.
They're finding them up there and finding them in large masses, and they were out competing the locals up there for food, such as the migratory birds and shorebirds, and that they're finding that possibly, since they were starving, that they were being beaten to their food by the cod and pollen.
Wow. And so you mentioned moose and caribou.
So for what I recall reading is that in the early 1900s, you would see a moose or two on the Seward Peninsula. You wouldn't see them in, you know, herds of cows or the bull. You'd see a few here and there. But as time came on, and I believe it started around the 1930s, they started to notice that more moose were moving into the Seward Peninsula and recorded. And they noticed that, too, they were following willows, low bush willows, that seem to pop up after you disturb the land. In the summer, if you go out for drives, you'll notice the lush greenery from the willows close to the road and onto mountainsides, and especially where railroad tracks or waterways were dug for the old mines, you'll notice they're sprouting up there due to the disturbed land. And they believe that because of that, the moose were able to move in, and since they will eat the low bush willows that are now becoming taller and larger than the roads.
And the caribou?
And caribou. So they found that the western Arctic caribou herd that will migrate partially through this part of the Seward Peninsula will fluctuate with population, in that it was on a low. And they've noticed that some of the populations will dip lower or higher depending on what's happening. They found that the portion coming through here was lower than usual with the population curve. But they also... We here have noticed that they're not coming through in at the certain times they were before the migrating season into the fall and winter times. So going out hunting was kind of a waste of resources if you didn't catch anything, and you were having to travel further and farther and using more resources to harvest caribou, and that they are waiting in certain spots that are warmer than others. You wouldn't want to go into a snowy mountain range where you still have food below you. And they're waiting until they're getting pushed out by weather and snow and ice, because at that point they would start their migration route. But they, from other hunters too, is that they haven't been seeing as many go through in certain spots, or their timing has changed to a later date when the weather is pushing them out, when winter's coming later and later throughout the fall.
So you talked about the willows, so that's the vegetation. I mean, and you said it's mostly on disturbed lands. Are the willows just even coming further north because they're able to grow further?
It would seem that. I don't believe we've covered too much into that in our climate adaptation plan. But it is noted that more and more trees and plants are moving further north as the... permafrost is melting, and there's the permafrost that would melt and that would thaw and then refreeze the seasons. And with our winters becoming shorter and a hotter spring, summer, and fall, is that permafrost, some of that is disappearing, so more plants are able to move further north and live in the different environments up here. And it's since some of it is not as harsh, they're able to winter it out and then bloom in the next year. So there are, I recall the last time they looked for invasive species, they didn't find anything that was too bad. That was a little bit before my time from a previous environmental director. But it is noticed that there are more plants, and the growing season is earlier and later, and that it is changing some of the times people harvest, like some of the willows. In the spring, they would harvest them. They were just the felt leaf willows, the young ones, and they call that sura. That's a source of greens. And others that they're finding that after the snow and ice melts, you can harvest. So
you mentioned the thawing of the permafrost. Are you finding slumping is happening a lot with that?
Yes, if there's slumping out, we've seen it in the tundra. We see it in mainly places where buildings are put up because of the pressure of the buildings. And the planet addresses Solomon's their what used to be their school is mm-hmm. now a B&B, and they're somewhat of an office out there. Mm-hmm. And they've noticed that they're having to level it more often because of the permafrost melt and slumping, and that would cause damage to the structure. And so they're needing to try and level it and keep it level as everything freezes and thaws as its frost heaves. Happens here in town too. Yeah, it's twice a year in the spring and the fall. But this, when you're out of town and kind of in a location where you'd think you built on permafrost, it's starting to melt and go.
Hmm. So in the climate adaptation plan, you mentioned, it kind of addresses certain changes that are being seen in permafrost and some coastal, like with sea ice changes. Are there five main or a number of main focuses that the plan? I haven't had a chance to read it yet, so I'm curious to hear what are the main different things, because I'm like, wow, there's so much, right? To
we do cover main aspects, and they do under the different portions which I have included the sea ice, the permafrost melt, but also the storms mm-hmm. that we've been having. Mm-hmm. It mainly addressed fall storms and their occurrence, their frequency, and also their intensity. Thank you. Their intensity without the sea ice to protect the coast.
So, can you talk about that? How is that process happening?
So, in the fall, we get Bering Sea as massive storms that we've seen, and these storms, will cause flooding and start eroding away. Nome has the seawall breakwater, and that was put up previously, in the 50s and 60s, and it would stand, and that would help protect the town from eroding off, since it is right on the ocean, or the Bering Sea, and that over the years, that's slowly been dropping in height and kind of probably going out into the sea and into the sand. But it's also due to how many storms we receive. We do receive storms in the summer, but they're never as intense as a fall or winter storm, where the it'll be 50-mile-per-hour winds, 60-mile-per-hour winds, and that will cause waves and high tides, and that'll erode away at riverbanks and coastal areas if the water reaches it. And without the ice there to stop the wave action or the tides rising, that's increasing the amount of erosion or loss of coastal areas. One that we thought we had was located right off the Port of Nome at West Beach, but due to the port being put out, there was a net accumulation of sand, which was actually protecting what was considered the Seaview Cemetery, and now known as Eskimo Cemetery Tract A, for the influenza victims in 1917-1918. Mm-hmm. That was a location, looking at historical pictures and maps, was, further out. To what extent, you can't quite exactly say, but it's been eroding, and there were stories from people that would go for a walk down the beach or a ride down the beach, and they would see coffins and different items and crosses washing up or sticking right out of the tundra. So after the port was put up, there became the net accumulation, which allowed for the water to be pushed farther back, and so it's not hit as hard with storms, it's not getting eroded as much, and now that some protection has been put up as it's being recognized as a cultural site, that it's being protected more. Before, it was believed that action was still happening with these more intense storms, but the sand and the stuff that's getting washed up, some of the debris caused more of a seawall for it.
Right. Are there plans in a Nome to extend the seawall or to rebuild it to help protect the town from these more powerful storms?
They, in the past few years, with some of these storms that have washed, that have even washed out the road, the Nome Council Highway out at Safety, called Safety Lagoon, there have been improvements in our seawall, especially going down the beach, down East Beach, to build it back up, because it, especially some of the storms where it's lobbing boulders onto the highway and rocks and huge logs, that they realize that they need to keep building that wall back up to protect the structures and the people here. Mm-hmm. They have done improvements in the past. I don't recall this last year. They haven't done any big improvements here in mm-hmm. town, but along the roadway to Solomon and Council, along the Safety Lagoon, they have improved that, as that gets hit every year.
Really? And you do think that you've seen that the storms are actually becoming more intense. But like you say, it's sea ice that's not there. So is the storms more intense, or is it the lack of the sea ice? Or is it a combination of both?
I think it is a combination of both, especially since you're going to have stronger winds right on the coast, and that'll blow some of those waves up. We will watch waves hit the seawall, and it'll just splash over and get all of Front Street wet and coated.
When was it, 2011, there was a really big fall storm, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't here for that, but it was like major flooding down Front Street from what I've heard, right?
You had to wear boots on Front Street or you'd get soaked, and
yeah.
there were probably rocks as big as my head kind of just rolling onto the road between the buildings, and especially further down where Front Street just becomes a residential zone, there was things, you know, logs showing up in people's yards and people's windows getting damaged.
Wow.
So without the sea ice there to protect us, and it adds to the intensity of the storm for the wave action.
Right. So in your next plan that you're thinking of doing, or that you are going to be embarking on shortly, what different things do you think should be included in that plan?
I think it'll, right now we'll be following up on what we have in there, and we will ask the people that were listed 2 years ago when it was published how far they've come with some of their plans or their actual programs or activities that they were doing, since they include the environmental programs from other tribes, and the climate adaptation has been a hot topic the last few years, especially with some of the accelerated climate change that we're seeing.
What were a few of the suggestions in the first plan, then? What were some of the tasks people were to carry out?
From what I can recall is that we were looking at for the how to adapt to the sea ice, not just physically getting our boats ready earlier, hauling our equipment to where we can launch our boats or go hunting, but also regulatory. Is that if there's any regulations with subsistence hunting or even hunting in general, that we look at how we can change the regulations to be more in time with seasons, because before there was no season to hunt. It was when they showed up, and that could be any time of the year, and that was when you harvest or had your resources. Whether it was berry picking or grain picking, agriculture, and harvesting. And for that, we've seen with the caribou, that was actually one regulation that was brought up and passed before, with opening the season a little bit or extending the season when the caribou show up, and also for bears, because bears are coming out of hibernation earlier. As we've seen, there have been bears coming out since the end of March and April, and if they're out, now would be the time people prefer to harvest them while they have a hardy coat, and they're not scavenging for anything and starting to get kind of not ruddy, but where their hide's not going to be as nice, or the meat's not going to be what you want.
Yeah.
You don't want to find an animal that's been scavenging for a month compared to an animal that just came out of hibernation that was set, because that hide is used, you know, can be used for multiple different things, from a blanket to like a rug to keep your floor warm, or even just putting up on the wall, and that'll help insulate. And Not many people will eat bear meat, but if you can, you know, people that have, and they turn it into different meals. But if it doesn't smell right, because you don't have to harvest that meat, they're not going to. But if it's, you know, still what they consider edible, and they want it, so.
Yeah. Hmm. So did the regulations get changed then?
Yes, the actual, for the bear hunting, it did open up. They did open up the seasons after. There was a big push from seeing not only the bears coming out earlier and staying out later, but also more bears and more sows having cubs. So the bear population was believed to be increasing, and competition for resources, moose, caribou, fish.
So if the bear population was increasing, obviously they were finding enough to eat and to reproduce.
Yes.
Yes.
Was that noted throughout, like, the Seward Peninsula, or was it, like, an even bigger range for that? I don't know how big it was.
I remember, I think it was in 2013 that I recall that it started because of seeing more bears and them breaking into cabins also because of their population.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing more of them was about 2013, and then there was different organizations that came together and said, these regulations need to be changed. It doesn't make sense to just have it during one period of time when nobody really wants to hunt that animal for any particular reason, the hide or the meat. So there were regulations written with letters of support, strong letters of support from multiple organizations, and that was submitted to the Board of Game, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And the regulations were changed because there was enough given information to show a reason to. And that's one thing that we're looking at for other resources, such as caribou, which I mentioned. But if it changes even more, then it would be asked to be written so that it reflects the time to harvest them correctly and anything that wouldn't damage, like, the population.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that for fishing, too.
Mm-hmm.
In the summer, the fish are showing up earlier, a lot earlier. And before a certain date, they don't even have permits from Fish and Game to subsistence fish. It's kind of like if you caught it, then you get to keep it because there's only a few. But when the main runs start coming in, you have to have, after a certain date, you need to have your fishing permit or license from Fish and Game.
So will you be trying to change those dates too then?
Those, I don't think there's a real problem with those dates because people know to get it, and it's more for the information so that they realize how much is harvested and utilized. There have been multiple studies by different organizations and consortiums about how much of a certain type of food, whether it's fish, marine mammal, or land mammal, and vegetation, and it varies from household to household, but they got the general numbers of how much each family eats. And fishing is a big portion. People, you know, you can do almost anything with fish. So,
and it's high source protein.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you have, like, when you go out hunting or fishing, is there one that you like to harvest the most, or like your, like, I don't know, even like your favorite food? That
that's a tough question. I certainly do like hunting and getting seals and oobrooks. That was a big part of growing up, especially with my grandparents, and always having consider native food or Eskimo food around, and fish, and seal oil is a delight. My daughters love seal oil, and they love all sorts of different foods. They love walrus. I know before, when the sea ice was breaking off earlier, in the earlier 2013, 2014, 2015, there was concern for marine mammals, but it was found that it wasn't the marine mammals that were struggling for their populations. It was our access to that marine mammal to hunt, as conditions were tough. So
the marine animal numbers were the same. It was just your ability to be able to harvest like you had been that was the issue.
Yes, it was. As we see, animals will adapt and continue to adapt to survive. And it's when you stay stagnant is that when you're going to start to see changes from your own. So that's kind of what we've noticed, was that their populations were, you know, probably were changing depending on how they were adapting to that certain instance. Especially without sea ice, I know some animals would struggle to have their young stay afloat, that can't float as long or swim as long. Mm-hmm. But they're, like right now, they're going through the Bering Strait and up into the northern Bering Sea and Beaufort Sea and Chukchi.
Mm-hmm. I saw some really cool video today.
That brings me to
just St. Lawrence Island, the walrus.
Yeah, just thinking something really interesting about human adaptation. So animal adaptation, human adaptation. So the traditional knowledge and the things that your grandfather would have probably taught you and your father taught you when you were going out hunting, how have you had to adapt to that knowledge?
I think the best knowledge was when they were giving to us younger generation about the ice, the sea ice, when it's safe to be on and go out. Because they were worried, especially when they noticed it was going out earlier and it was thinner. It was, I remember going out once, walking on the ice with my cousin. We took his dog, too, just to go out. And we could hear something underneath us, and we could feel it slightly, that the ice was starting to, we could feel the waves and the action underneath. And we didn't feel that was safe. And it was pretty thick ice. That's why we weren't able to test how thick it was, but we didn't want to be out there if anything happened. So we learned that. And also in the later years when we were having a harder time accessing some of our animals, seals were going on the inside of ice pans that were rotten, and they considered themselves, you know, to be safe there because nothing is going to go over that to reach them, and they're protected from any marine mammals that are coming after them under. And harvesting those became a challenge because we didn't want to go through and break, and you were stuck in the middle of an ice pan. And sometimes we would utilize what we had. We'd find, you know, sometimes we had wood or logs floating, and we used those as bridges. We would row and try to do what we could to carry the boat across some of that, and taking risks that were probably otherwise warranted if we were able to harvest other animals. So. But probably how sea ice is and the conditions, and not quite ice hopping, because kids are getting in trouble for it now because of the situation. We've had 2 cases in the past 2 weeks of kids getting stuck ice hopping. But out hunting, I don't think we would be considered kids at our age and our teens, late teens hunting, but we were taking some of those risks that probably would seem highly dangerous, and if you fell in, that would be pretty bad, especially if you're 20 miles out in a boat or 15 miles out in a boat in the middle of an ice pack.
Hmm. Wow.
Just to go back to the willows, you were talking about, it's where land has been uprooted or changed, that the willows are growing up. What about just even along shallow rivers or waterways? That hasn't happened. Have you noticed anything there?
Somewhat. It does seem that the willows are growing there more so. You can tell they are growing, but not at the rate if the land would have been disturbed for them. But they are starting to set root, and it's probably with the thaw melt cycle and freeze. Mm. Willows are hardy plants. They'll get mowed down by bunnies and moose and everything in between, and then come back the next year.
Right.
It's amazing. Yeah.
They are. Everybody bunny. Yeah. And what about then if the caribou are changing, the change in lichen? Have you seen changes in lichen at all?
I cannot speak to that personally, but I have talked to some people looking into it, and they're researching into that, and that maybe the lichen might not be changing their seeing, or it might be the access to the lichen, since we have had freezing rain events in the middle of winter in December and January. I can speak to having that happen, to where with the freezing rain, it coats everything and then it turns into a layer of ice. And with the low snowfall year, that freezing rain makes it harder for everything that is using the lichen. They have to dig for lichen to survive, or even any animals that live on the tundra on that top surface and hibernate there. That causes issues for them.
I was aware that you were getting freezing rain, but I didn't realize that it was that much.
And for a while we were having rain maybe April or March, and then it started to freezing, and it's been kind of cold these last few days, and you can see where everything's refreezing.
Yes.
We've been in that cycle since late March.
And it seems like a friend of mine lives in St. Michael, and she was saying that this past winter, like, they haven't really had snow. Like, we got a ton of snow here, but they had more, like, they had that kind of a continual freezing rain for most of their winter, it seemed. I was like, wow. Yeah, I was like, we've got so much snow here, but in other parts of the region, it seemed like there was... Yeah, kind of more of that happening too.
Are you finding you had more snow because the winters were a little bit milder?
Or just kind of like warmer, wetter winters, I think, in general, from what I'm understanding. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because with my 1 year in Fairbanks and the one last year, it was -50 before it wasn't, is that you don't see a lot of precipitation when it's -30, -40 out. Just the moisture in the air doesn't turn into precipitation. But when it starts to warm up into the negative single digits and the single digits in the 20s, in 30s, you'll definitely start to see more snow. Mm-hmm. And then once you get up into the mid to high 30s, it starts raining. And that freezing rain is kind of where that comes from, with those temperatures.
Mm. And we had like all of February. It was just one snowstorm after the next. And it seemed to be kind of hovering in the, you know, like the low 30s, mid 30s. And then I think we had some rain. Yeah, it was a mixture of very interesting weather.
Do you get an increase in fires then, if you're getting later or earlier springs, later falls? Have you noticed any changes in, not too much, in fire pattern?
Maybe, I know some people have noted that some parts of the surface are a little more wet and humid. And of course, the only place I've really seen lightning and thunder before in Nome was as a kid. Where they had big wide rivers when I was in Koyuk. I remember lightning and thunderstorms and the interior part of the peninsula of the Cougar Rock Road near Cottonwood and Pilgrim. You'd see lightning striking mountains in the far distance once in a while, and you'd hear it. There'd be more rain. But I feel like we've had more thunder and lightning here in Nome the past 5-6 years. At one point, there was a few tundra fires by Dexter, maybe 12 miles up inland from Dexter, and then by Salmon Lake. I've heard there were small fires where it was extremely dry from the storms rolling in, and out at Cougar Rock Way, Coosa Train area. Mm-hmm. There was a
fire. Yeah, just a couple of years ago, right? There was one. The first one, I think, that you mentioned, I remember hearing
about
that one.
Yeah, it was big. It jumped the road. And that it wasn't spreading, like, far and wide like some fires. It was kind of just went with where the wind was pushing it at that time. And as most people think, tundra is a bog, and it is. It's wet. Most people don't go out there without boots. And this was just dry times, and then when it would get really wet and that hot weather would mix, we'd get these tundra fires.
Interesting. So we talked about the sea ice, especially not being shore fast, and you talked about some of the thickness and the timing. I mean, this year it's gone out so early. How is this? We were talking a little bit about changes to natural resources. So what are you going to be looking at for your future adaptation plans?
Probably having resources ready earlier would be my my best guess. Some people's boats are still frozen. My boat is still frozen in my parent-in-law's backyard. And some people mentioned they spent 4 hours digging out their boat, and that's quite a bit of time. You know, I'm relatively young. I could do it, but with a broken finger, it would be harder. And even more so, I think their boat was out at camp where they could launch it easily, where mine is on a trailer. I would have to dig the trailer out, too, and that's more time. And
so basically putting things up in the fall has to be a little bit as changed so that when it's time to go out, you have your equipment ready to go out.
Yes.
Is what you're saying. Okay, I understand.
Just having it ready there, you know, probably covered with the tarp and, you know, moved once or twice after the snow falls. Kind of like if you wanted something, you put it away for the winter. If you didn't, like, you had some other stuff and you left them out, you wouldn't see them until, you know, May, June. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how it is with some items, especially with this, the amount of snow we've received.
Is there, like, if someone doesn't have space necessarily where they live to store a boat, is there, like, a public space? I've never heard of one, I guess.
Lease. It's mainly for the port and harbor if you have a larger vessel. You can lease. But there's that one location that they call a small boat harbor that's right there off Belmont, right before the bridge, and that was
where you see all the dredges in summertime.
Was supposed to be subsistence, and they were the ones. If it was mainly a subsistence vessel, if you only use that to go out hunting or fishing, then you wouldn't need registration or anything. You just have to, you know, let the harbor master or the port director know and say. That's how my vessel is I don't use it for any commercial resource. It was only for subsistence spring hunting and going out and setting a subsistence fishing net. So mine wouldn't require that in the registration or info. But as that's kind of getting crowded out by other vessels, mining vessels appear in some commercial vessels, it became harder to just leave your subsistence resources out.
Interesting. Yeah, because I guess in the summertime I'll see a lot of the dredging vessels throughout the summer, right? And it's, that would be really tricky to, I don't know.
How's that going to change the dredging then? I mean, will they be able to start earlier and go later now?
I've seen dredges already out.
Already?
Which I was super surprised, yeah.
Two or three dredges, and usually those are people who are pretty serious about it, and have their stuff can be pulled out in an instant if the ice came back in, or they could leave it there for weeks because if you maintain your equipment correctly, it goes with subsistence vessels too. Yeah. Because sometimes you'd go out and you'd be gone for a week or two, and if you especially got stuck in an ice pack. Now, I've heard of it once or twice, the people getting stuck and they have a satellite phone or a two-way communication and they'll call into work. But before, it'd be you'd go out and you'd have a little Coleman stove and you'd melt and you'd, like, just have pilot bread and some longer-term rations, not just a couple home-cooked meals ready.
Interesting. So I'm just thinking that if they're dredging longer in the season, what's that going to do to the ocean floor and how is that going to change things? Or is that not a reasonable question?
I think it's reasonable. It's just some of the studies they've seen is that I think that mainly would affect our crab, baby, you know, the baby little crabs that come in closer to shore. But there was one study by a commercial outfit that was doing due diligence and doing their research on the area that wanted to mine on a large scale, especially put their dredge out in the water as soon as possible in there. But what they found earlier in the season is that conventionally the crab would go out a little after some of that ice would go out, and they'd go offshore, further offshore, and then they would just miss whenever something would happen, whenever a dredge or there would be some near shore disturbance from weather. that because sometimes you'll see that there's or it'll be pretty shallow going out, and Bering Sea's fairly shallow throughout. There are a couple deep spots, but that they get out, and then very, very few people end up sucking up crabs, from what I understand, in their dredging operations. But with the everything changing, I don't think that that research has been updated in 6-8 years.
Yeah. So is it affecting also then how much the people crabbing are getting if they don't have as much ice to go out with?
It's a very good question. Yeah. There was actually on the radio they were mentioning some people were being interviewed, crabbers, because we do have some hardy long-term crabbers that'll handle the last piece of ice. And they will, right now, where the subsistence crabbing area was right in front of Nome. And without that, there's no subsistence crabbing through the ice. You can't go out and set a pot from a boat until summer crabbing starts. You need that goes with the fishing permits. But there are people going to where the ice is holding on up and down the beach and setting their pots there and for the commercial crabbing season. That, you know, it's probably going 30 miles, 40 miles in each direction.
Interesting.
When you think, Jacob, of all the changes that are happening, does one, I don't know, does one of kind of the things that you've observed, is it of most concern to you, or like, I know all of, or I imagine, you know, like all of them, there's just so much happening. But do you have one that you're, like, perhaps most concerned, I guess, about?
I can't just say I'm mainly concerned about one. I mean, I think
it's all interconnected.
Yeah. A lot of what we're taught is we're all connected, in that there's an environmental ecosystem, but growing up here, you're in the environmental ecosystem. You're along that food chain. You're not the big guy on top. You're slightly below the brown bear most of the time. So that's how I grew up here. And I can't say just one. I think the main, one of the big factors is rising temperatures throughout the year. There are less days where it's very cold, to where your heater needs to kick on. Some people tell me they have their system that they just put in tells them how many hours their system is on per month, and it change, like, it'll compare them last month or this month to last month. And I mean, it's great if you're trying to save money on fuel oil, which is a pain here, the price, but for everything else, it's kind of a trade-off. Especially since subsistence resources are a major factor of people living here. I mean, 120 years ago, you couldn't live here without subsistence resources. Now it's becoming more grocery-based.
Grocery-based at a very high price. Is that because people are not doing as much subsistence work harvesting anymore, or is it just change in life?
I feel like it's a little bit of both. There are people who definitely subsist to, you know, they'll subsist till the end. I have family like that, and I hope to be like that. But there are just, especially with more people, and eventually it becomes a competition of resource, like moose. Even though there are moose here, there's not enough for every family. You know, one moose is plenty for probably three families for a winter. But with the population increasing from people moving here and more people having more children and larger families, is it becomes harder because of, especially when the hunt count goes down, or the subsistence quota goes down. Here, or the quota, there's no subsistence tier hunt here in Nome.
So, like, you're allowed to take so many moose per year or caribou per year? Is that what you mean by a quota?
Yeah, for moose, the quota is based on how many they see in their analysis they do the fishing game. Where caribou, that they also have that, but the quota was implemented to 20 per calendar year, 10 per calendar year. It varies between general management unit, but it is like 5 per day, and some people hunt for proxy hunt for multiple families, and mm-hmm. they'll fill out a ticket with someone else's name. Yeah. But for moose, it's only one per hunter, and it's usually you group up and hunt for that with your friends or family, and people are coming to Nome and also harvesting that resource.
So do you get trophy hunters, you mean, coming, or just people coming from other parts of Alaska wanting to for that for their subsistence?
Both. There are people that live in other places, mainly populated urban areas, mm-hmm. Anchorage. They come here and they hunt, and they're hunting with their friends that live here. Maybe they used to live here and they just come back. But it is a competition at that point of resources of who gets one, who doesn't. And, everyone does share. I mean, you're always mm-hmm. going to get moose or caribou from somebody, or if someone has a reindeer herd, and get some meat there. But it just becomes a little harder, and then that takes it out that family has less subsistence resource, and that's... You try to make up one resource with another by fishing or gathering.
Yeah. You mentioned reindeer. People still using reindeer?
There's a small population here, the Davis herd and the Kakarik herd out of Teller. Those are the main ones here in Nome. If you go farther out, sometimes you will see some herds kind of wandering mm-hmm. into where you'd see them from maybe the northern Sud Peninsula. But there are still managed herds on... St. Michael mm-hmm. has a herd, mm-hmm. and they're a large enough herd that they can sell to a butcher, and then we see the meat here at the market.
I just saw it in the grocery store yesterday. Yep. I always love to see it. Because I don't recall, and maybe I just hadn't picked it up, but a couple of years ago, I don't recall seeing it in the store. Maybe I just didn't see it at the time.
They have it once, they have it for a while, and then they'll sell out, and then they have to wait at market, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because there are some commercial places that'll buy, a couple hundred pounds of reindeer to mix it in with other meat, mm-hmm. and that's how you kind of
go further,
So we'll see it here at the store once in a while. Usually it's like one steak or... mm-hmm. caribou, mm-hmm. or not caribou, I mean stew, sorry. Reindeer. It's just reindeer, you'll see it in stew chunks, and that's mm-hmm. just, and then, I mean, some people buy it from a herd owner, and you pay a varying price from herd to herd on their deer, and then usually they'll tell you, it's their mating season, only shoot this or that, and they have, mm-hmm. there's a specific ratio of bulls to cows they'd like, so if they feel like they have too many in either category, or they'll say, these ones are better this time of the year, and we do have enough to harvest it.
So we've talked about harvesting land mammals and sea mammals and fish. What about berries? Has there been much of a change with the changing vegetation and temperatures, the berry numbers?
I do feel the berries have increased
quite a bit. That's a good
thing. Yeah, it's good. For how much they've increased, I can't remember too much as a kid. I'd just run around and eat them. And at this point, I don't pick them. I do pick them. My family picks them, but I'm watching out for predators. Yeah. And I do feel like there are a lot more berries. So I've seen people picking more berries, but their timing has indeed changed. Especially with the amount of water we'll receive from spring breakup and spring melt, and also how much rain we receive over the summer. I feel like it's getting earlier and earlier in the year that people are finding ripe berries in different locations.
So are we talking blueberries and cranberries?
Mainly blueberries, and cranberries do come a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Blackberries.
Mm-hmm. Salmon berries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're always very good.
It seemed to be pretty early, right, this past summer?
Yeah.
I think. Oops.
And also with berries, the bears love berries.
Oh, yeah.
So, again, another food source for the bears. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about permafrost now. And the shifts in... I guess one interesting question that we talked with Taze in our last one was... So all this is happening. This is affecting people here, animals here. How do we make other people aware, and why is that important?
I feel like the first way that people become aware is when they first come here and realize it firsthand. When I think a big thing would be is like, hey, can I come and do this? Because they see it and they're like, no, the season opens then. Then they kind of get open-eyed that maybe it hasn't always been that way. Or in comparison to previous years, I've seen pictures of 100 years ago of some places with glaciers and how much they've melted down, or how coastal erosion has happened. And that kind of opens people's eyes when, if you see it like right in front of someone's their habitat, their home, their camp, there are people's camps that are right on the bank of a river right now because it's snaked over so much at an accelerated rate. And that's kind of how you bring it to people, and they don't realize that it can happen to anyone here. No one, it's kind of like an occupational hazard to live here and do that. From How to Train a Dragon, they mentioned that anything can happen at any time here, especially, and that's kind of the scary part, is some things that you can plan for, you can't plan for anymore because they just happen. And it's important because our population up here is definitely increasing, and with human population increasing, we're going to see the effect on the environment around us. Part of the coastal management is shipping and ports. Nome is possibly going to have a deep draft port in the next 5 or so years, depending on how it all goes between the city and the Army Corps of Engineers. And in which, a deep draft port would be good for economic and national security here in Nome. We'll be able to launch an icebreaker or a Coast Guard vessel or anything to conduct a rescue, or shipping, if we can get resources in and out. These all are going to have effects, especially on subsistence resources that people here do rely on. And changing those adverse changes will just make it a lot tougher for people to adapt faster. It's one thing to say, yeah, we can head out earlier, a week earlier next year hunting, but sometimes you're not always thinking of that. You're thinking, I have a giant puddle under my house causing my house might get swallowed by a sinkhole, which is very real here. No, there are houses that need fill year after year, and you can't always worry about other food security in a sense, or you want to, but you just don't have the resources and time to worry. Like if something happened to a vessel and it's stuck here and it needs other oil spill response or something taken care of. Yeah. So it's very real, because sooner or later things are going to change, and they're going to change so fast people can't adapt. It's kind of been seen before.
Are you going to be addressing that in your adaptation plans, these new ones that you're coming up with? It's not just 2 years, but 5 years, 10 years, 25 years, 50 years?
Yeah, that's in the plan, that we're going to continue to look at it and keep going with the organizations and how we're planning to adapt. And a lot of them, there's, like you said, there's a lot of great ideas. Just the funding for it, and looking at the funding for all of this, sometimes you can't cover it even when there is an abundance. It's just, what can you do on a small scale, your small steps? If your water goes out and you don't want to burn up your circulation pump and then have all your pipes freeze next time it happens. And just small steps like that you're monitoring some certain aspects, or if you have water under your house, you get it pumped out or fill put in when it's needed, even a couple, handfuls at a time. Mm-hmm. And for like erosion purposes, the same thing there is, you keep an eye on that. Maybe you just put a few stakes up, or you put some small barriers down every time, a couple rocks here, a couple rocks there. Right. And it's not just a big project that'll solve it. It's continual work and effort into it.
Yeah. It's an ongoing effort.
Yes.
So
So thinking back from when you were younger to today, just thinking back to some of the favorite places that you like to go to, can you describe what they looked like then and what they look like now?
Well, one of my favorite places as a young teen was out on the ice. And it was quiet. You could walk around and work on a tan. And now it's harder. You can do it on the ocean, but you're not on the ice. You're in a boat. And you got a motor. It's loud. Generally, you're with more than one person, but when you're on the ice, you know, you can take some of those risks and not worry that you're going to fall in. I think that's my favorite. That would be my favorite.
And Katie, you wanted to ask some questions to help you with some education and curriculum, perhaps?
Well, it was kind of the question that you asked kind of answered, or was a different way of asking the same question that I had. yeah, I guess I was thinking about, like, my niece and two nephews live in Chicago, and how can I best kind of, you know, like, share what, and they're definitely seeing things, but it's very different what they're seeing and what they're observing and, like, changes that they're perceiving. And yeah, how can I best kind of, what message can I share with them about all that is happening here, to potentially encourage, yeah, different sorts of, like, thinking about, you know, our daily actions and things like that. So yeah, like, it's they just need to come visit. Yeah. As well, but no, but, like, you know, like, how, yeah, what type of messaging for kids that live far away and kind of aren't quite able to kind of really get a sense of, like, things are happening fast, you know? And but I heard a little bit of that. But yeah, I don't know if you have other kind of additional thoughts.
I know that before that there's the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, ANTHC, mm-hmm. their local environmental observer application. Yes. That's on mobile now and on the web. Mm-hmm. You can see what's happening. People are tracking more changes than I can tell you about here. People seeing bugs in the middle of winter, mm-hmm. or bugs moving farther north, such as ticks or even plants, mm-hmm. the invasive species. Some of those just people that are out and about that have a phone and take a picture of it with their smartphone and put it up, and they can get in contact with a professor or someone mm-hmm. who specializes in it. And that, you just seeing that, like, usually you only see that in magazines growing up, National Geographic and Reader's Digest, people asking, like, you're seeing the letters to the editor, or like, what's this about? And someone, and now that can happen almost in real time.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can ask a question and it gets answered. And if the person has done work here before, you know, people come up here to do studies on different animals, seabirds, migratory mm-hmm. birds, marine mammals. If you post that, just because, you know, a hunter like me might see something and I'll ask my buddies, they haven't seen it, maybe I'll put it up there, and then someone says, well, we haven't seen that in Nome. We might have seen it in X, Y location before, mm-hmm. and it's because of this. And then we'd know that something happened, for maybe there's a potential cause and effect with a lot of that. Mostly for invasive species, it's the their environment's changing and they're able to adapt into it or move up into a warmer place, or it's getting too hot and they have to move further north where it's colder. So,
and even with migratory birds, the first sighting of whatever bird. Mm-hmm. I certainly know the geese were earlier at Fairbanks this year than mm-hmm. they've ever been. So mm-hmm. are you seeing the bird migrations changing?
Before, yes. Yeah. We've seen birds showing up earlier. We've seen black brant. Mm. And we've seen it before where there's an open lead and someone out there just looking for seals, marine mammals, saw brant flying up, and then, you know, in another date they saw them flying down and they were just kind of waiting to go further north or further south, depending on what season it was. But there have been sightings of birds showing up earlier in some places, or even staying in one location a little bit longer because they're waiting for the weather to change where they're planning to go. I know someone heard a seagull the other day and said, "I just heard a seagull." Mm-hmm. And I listened really quietly, living at the west end of town near the port. I could swear I heard one too. And, you know, hearing a seagull here in April, it's a little early. And sometimes you'd hear some migratory birds that would follow herds of walrus or other animals. They'd clean up after them, or if there's anything, they'd pick through waste or different stuff. So those are the only animals we'd hear. We wouldn't hear exactly gulls or anything like that.
Interesting. That's another cool, like the Leo app. There's also the, I get rare bird alerts for iBird that you know, people have been like, wait a minute. there was a bald eagle that was spotted just recently in Unalakleet that was posted. Mm. And I'm guessing that was probably earlier. But yeah, these different kind of like ways of sharing that out. It's really neat to think of how that is kind of growing and then sharing out to people all over. So it's pretty awesome.
You said it's in real time.
Yeah.
Just not only the speed of change, but the speed of technology and how to connect is really quite amazing.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. So, Jacob, anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't talked about changes, and especially something that might help you as you go through on this new planning process?
I think food preparation was something, part of the plan I can bring up here. Mm-hmm. And before, people had kind of a underground food shelter place. And,
like a cache underground?
Yeah. And those were used before. I remember my great uncles having one at where they used to live out of town. And they would be like, don't go in there, you know, it's deep. It's cold. Mm-hmm. I'd see it, and even in the summers, they'd have it covered, and that was where they would put, you know, certain things, you know, cans or jars of stuff they wanted to preserve long term, or meat saved. And that used to be, I remember family telling me about it, and even school teachers saying, yeah, we had one in our village. We'd carve out a big hole or cave, and we'd bring snow and ice in there, line the walls, and that's where we kept our food and preserved it. And here, I know some places, if you plan to live there long term, you'd have one. But as Nome became more of a permanent settlement, people lived here. You couldn't quite just dig a hole in your front yard, so you wouldn't see it here in Nome. But then, you know, you have people's sheds or county trucks, and they'd keep a freezer in there, and that's where they'd keep all their frozen foods and other materials. And that became the norm, so we're kind of seeing that change. But possibly, like, are there other ways to preserve foods other than now the norm is vacuum sealing? We see tons of vacuum sealing. Mm-hmm. And you don't see it quite as much being dried as much, or even some dried foods are vacuum sealed, like jerky. And or preserved, people still preserve a lot of vegetables and seal oil and canning it, and fish and, you know, more moist, wet foods like fish and oils, anything that you'd jar or put it or preserve it in something. And you don't quite see that too much. You do see canning and jarring. You don't see it as much as I used to remember my parents canning and jarring fish for days and preserving all sorts of other food in seal oil here in Nome. I remember, you know, every time you'd go have an Eskimo feed at a relative's, you'd have a big jar, a jar of seal oil, and there'd always be greens, Syrah, beach greens, Dugayuks, and other stuff is preserved in seal oil. And that's, you know, you get a lot of nutrients from that. But when you kind of vacuum seal and freeze dry stuff, that's more of a convenience food there.
So people just aren't collecting the seal oil as much anymore, or the drying is just an easier and faster way of preserving the meat?
Yeah, I see with more meats dried in that sense, or just ground up mm-hmm. and put away, mm-hmm. or just chopped up and put away that in that sense. But it used to be more common in salting, you know, having layers of salted, yeah. even just some dried meat with salt over it to keep it from rotting. You don't see that too much, in that people are moving towards, you know, vacuum sealing and containing stuff. I'm sorry, I can't think of what other methods they were doing in that sense, but I do remember someone mentioning they changed the way they were drying fish to make dry fish. Mm-hmm. Instead of used to cut horizontal slabs, they were cutting it vertical slabs like they were going to smoke them, yeah, into strips, and they were drying faster and easier. And in some places, it is becoming harder to dry. If you're on the coast, sometimes you just get a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of rain. Mm-hmm. We've had it, and you can't dry fish in that. It rots. We've had family members get sick from eating some just to try it, and it didn't taste right, and made them, you know, they went and laid down and rested a couple of days, and having issues like that, botulism.
Yeah.
We've had a death and multiple sickness in the last year because of botulism and mm-hmm. and just moving away from fermentation or some of the resources they're fermenting it in to trusted resources.
So is there a different nutritional value, do you think? Or is it still the same nutrition, it's just a way of being prepared?
I think there is a nutritional value to having it, you know, jarred or in seal oil, because you contained all that in there. And where you dry it, sometimes you'll lose moisture. People will soak it in stuff, and you know, you like flavor from time to time, but if you soak or brine something in something extremely salty, you're going to increase blood pressure mm-hmm. and other, and then people have issues with that here, and heart issues because of too much sodium and stuff. You know, just if you have flavor in it, that's okay, but completely going to drying it or turning it into jerky and then just putting it away like that.
So if you got a seal and you're not using the seal oil, I'm just naive because I've never seen a seal. I've never participated in that. Caribou, moose, yes, but not in seal. So where's the oil going, or how are they not rendering it down to get that oil?
Some people, I've seen some people that will just get it and give it to dog mushers. I mean, mm-hmm. it can be a task to render mm-hmm. a bunch of seal oil or clean it, because it takes a lot more time in refining. And I mean, you can make a lot of seal oil, and some people maybe aren't eating as much. You know, they're not using as much. So it's just, they don't need to do that. But I know in some places they still do it in batches of 5 gallons, and they put everything in there. That's how they preserve it in their shed, and that's what I remember is people preserving it in, like, the jar, large pickle jars and other ration jars, and are now buckets. So, and that's...
Right. Have you noticed, does the change in material, like, between a jar and the 5 gallon buckets, does that change the flavor of seal oil?
I believe it does.
Does it?
In a sense, and I remember when they were first issuing warnings about water bottles and mm-hmm. them warming up.
Right.
So mm-hmm. and then leaching out, you know, different chemicals, and that can be... And I know it's probably not much of a risk up here, but that's still, I feel the same, as it's going to leach out more out of plastic, and mm-hmm. It may be more convenient, but that's the trade-off, is that you might have chemicals and other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you're saying there's not as much traditional canning and preservation that happens today like it did 30 years ago, perhaps.
Yeah.
I could say the same for where I come from. You know, I used to can hundreds of jars of whatever, but people don't do that anymore because people are now working, they have a different lifestyle. You need a lot of time to do all of that, a lot of time. And that's just something that doesn't exist anymore. So with people having multiple jobs and working, is that part of maybe the reason?
I want to say yes, that is. People things are becoming more expensive, you know, to just live in general.
Yeah.
To afford your resources, gas is like $4.50 a gallon. And that's if you drive a vehicle like a truck, you know, that's not very fuel efficient. If you're hauling all your gear, your boat or snow machine or anything, you have to spend more to transport it to where to get it and then launch. And firearms, you know, you gotta have a firearm and ammo or resources and food. Then if you're not hunting on the weekend, you're taking time off work, and some people don't have, you know, paid leave or
flexible jobs that allow for subsistence blended with westernized work schedules.
Yeah. So in essence, you're losing work money and then having to go out and make up for it hunting. Whereas, you know, if you're not very successful, you just spent a bunch of monetary resources and with no yield or low yield. And then it kind of trades off. It's easier to go buy a steak for whatever, a pound, $6.99 a pound, and call that good.
Mm-hmm. So just change in sedentary lifestyles.
Yes.
Yeah. Combined with changes on climate and environment and everything else, and all of this have an accumulative effect.
Yes. I feel like we're seeing that more. That people are working more and subsisting less, and it's just harder. It's becoming harder to subsist if you're working, in a sense, because then you got the 2 days a week that you would go hunting, and sometimes it doesn't always pan out.
Mm-hmm.
Especially weather-wise, if you know it's good Wednesday, Thursday, and you're looking out your office window and wishing you were out there.
Yeah.
Then Thursday, Friday come along, and it's raining, and then it starts snowing, and then it starts storming.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what about a cultural change? I mean, what about, you know, employers and working environments that are flexible to that?
There's
some movement, I think, in that, at least I've heard recently, like,
mm-hmm.
here in our office, we're trying to do a little bit more of, like, saying, wow, you know, this could be a great opportunity to go out and get berries and kind of like being able to use some of that time I feel like I've heard of other places locally that are doing that as well.
My employer allows subsistence leave. They value that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if I can advocate for it and what they're doing. It's nice because some people go out and take beautiful pictures, and then people are like, yeah, I'm gonna take leave next week to go out and do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least get out and try to. And I mean, it was a cultural thing. You'd go out and have a picnic,
mm-hmm.
quite a bit. You go drive in the family sedan and stop off somewhere. People like to go to Salmon Lake and or to a bridge, and there's little fire pits, and you go do that, and then you can go pick berries right off, or you
mm-hmm.
can go fish. That was kind of culturally, if you didn't have a boat, you couldn't go up river, and we used to picnic all the time when we were looking. We'd go fishing, or my uncle would look for moose and caribou and anything else. And my previous employer also had that written in the subsistence leave, and they valued it too. And then it kind of does help if eventually, you know, for 2 weeks out of the year no one's in the office and everyone has a cough and it's actually a hunting season, then it makes sense for the administration to realize that value there.
I think the schools are looking at, you know, different school calendars to be able to do that as well. And yeah, there's been some good conversations.
So maybe when the time is allotted and it's culturally valued more by employers and people, maybe a bit more of returning back to that would be a feasible thing because you would have the time.
I do believe that. I remember in high school that for a while during the moose hunting season, teachers would be like, yeah, it's moose season. We can't plan anything they need during these 2 weeks, because that's when the regulatory season is for that, and people would go out and take their kids. Excuse me. And they could be out all 2 weeks. And sometimes in the spring, there aren't as many... I feel like there wouldn't be as many marine hunters going out in the spring. And they would have to, like myself, I would dedicate every Sunday. Wind, Rain, or Shine. But during the week, I feel like in the spring there are some. I feel like there's more pressure now for the schools to realize that. And right now, especially since it's been moving, the ice breakup's been moving and hunting's been moving earlier and earlier, that it's colliding with school. You know, you can't just pull your kid out when you've already missed 2 weeks for snow days and sick days, and then truancy becomes an issue, especially if they're studying, you know, for college or for certain exams that are important. So it's tough to balance it throughout the year.
Mm-hmm. And like you say, with things changing from year to year, it's not, well, we can mandatorily say that this is the week it's going to happen, because the ice might go out before or after that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So flexibility.
But yeah, there's no set date in any government, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, of when you can or cannot harvest a marine mammal. But it's just when it's there, and that's what, that being said, around everything else causes, you know, complications and mm-hmm. clashes in schedules.
Yeah. Oh, I was gonna. So you're on the Walrus Commission?
Yes.
And that. Tell me a little bit more about your role on the commission. And
so I started off being appointed as the Walrus Commissioner for Nome Eskimo Community in 2015 when I started. They asked for the commissioner to come to the meeting, and it was within my work role to go. Personally, I mean, I've gone up and I've been, you know, from me to you to a walrus on the ice, and just kind of, I was like, okay, well, it looks like it's dead. I can't tell if it was shot or someone just hit it and then it swam off. And they popped up and woke up and weren't too happy someone was 5 feet staring at them. I haven't gone out to harvest that yet, but my role actually is as vice chair of the Walrus Commission. And I believe that was looked on as a younger member that can be more into progression with things changing and not having or trying to work with how things are changing now, especially in not just the subsistence climate, but the social, economical, political climate of everything is going to change, and that we can adapt to it and not be stuck with policies and looking at how things were 50 years ago when some people remember it, and that probably was the good time when they had ice and a reasonable season they could predict with weather and weather patterns they could predict traditionally. But now it's looking at, there's also a global picture involved, that there's going to be shipping from large nations wanting to go through, and Alaska being at one of those focal points, how that can affect it. So I'm kind of seen in that, and that I can work and comprehend some of these even larger pictures with some of these companies that are coming to talk about it, or organizations to talk about it, that see values in studying or looking at adapting to that.
So what is the mandate of the Walrus Commission? I know the Whaling Commission.
I'm sorry, I'm trying
to... That's okay. Don't take your time. Like, I can see your role in it, and overall, what did the commission see their mandate or role as?
Okay. So the official mandate of the Eskimo Walrus Commission is to protect the population for future use and harvest.
Right. And that makes sense then, yeah, how you're in there as a key. Yeah.
And the commission, it's... the commission collaboratively, like, works with
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Okay. Geological Service, State of Alaska, because they
all have a number of different kind of...
The main regulatory body is the Fish and Wildlife Service under the MMPA, but the Geological Service and the State of Alaska also have walrus research. Mm-hmm. Clauses in there, and they partner up in some places, and there's actually a sanctuary, I think that's where it's more of a down in southwest, there's a little island, not a little, but there's an island that's protected, and you can't harvest or do anything on there. You can't disturb it. It's kind of, so they have that, and they do some research on walruses there, and the U.S. Geological Survey does it with the Fish and Wildlife Service up out of Point Lay, where the haul out site has been these last 5 years.
Right. And how long have you been on the commission?
Since 2015.
So when you started your boat
job. Oh, cool. I didn't realize since 2015. That's awesome. Yeah.
So my dad actually was one of the first people to get it going.
Oh.
And with the receiving a grant to fund it and get it going to start the cooperative agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a co-management body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he was there. And then since he had many different endeavors and working, he left that, but just stayed listening and was part of the Park Service Beringian panel.
Mm-hmm.
They've worked before.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me about it, and that's where I've got a lot of my background for this understanding and how some of the politics can work.
So is your grandparents still alive?
None of my grandparents are still alive.
I'm sorry about that. So your parents are still alive?
My mother is. My father passed away 2 years ago.
I'm sorry. I just was going to ask. So in talking with your mom then, does she talk about how things used to look and be compared to today?
Yeah. My mom actually was born here in the mainland and grew up on King Island quite a bit. So she remembers when the island would be surrounded by ice and they would, you know, they'd get down on the ice and they'd hop on a little dog sled and go around the island to go crabbing or go hunting around. Or if they, like, when they had to get on their boats and go between mainland and shore, because the only way by was barge or skin boat.
Yeah.
She mentions, like, when we had more ice or how certain conditions were, because she did grow up subsisting to... She mentions it here and there, but she doesn't bring it up too much. Right. She's working on what's happening now.
Yeah.
It's good to reminisce, but...
No, I agree it's good to reminisce, but it's just interesting, you know, when that would come up. You know, like, oh, I've never seen that before, or, gosh, I haven't seen storms that bad, or, you know.
I remember my dad and her, they would talk about it, or when roads would open super early, when they put the roads in the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
Then, we'd get snow for... you know, 8 months, 9 months of the year, ideally. And then they'd clear up, and we're getting roads opening extra early. And they can clear roads even earlier because they're not pushing against, you know, glaciated blocks of ice. They're able to move snow off the road, and people are able to get out by vehicle and then, you know, take off a snow machine or boat, depending on where they were going from different locations, which allows greater access to that whatever resource they're harvesting.
Yeah.
Remember when the road was open out to Salmon Lake and a little further up until late December, mid-December?
Mm-hmm.
Then it finally snowed in, and then the next year they were out back on their early May clearing snow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yet all that clearing of snow then exposes that earth, which probably absorbs more warmth, which just compounds things again.
Yeah, you'd see it around the road. Clearing faster, but sometimes that would cause washout issues, and that was common before, especially when they didn't have roads built up as much. You'd see roads get washed out, and you have like a 5-foot dip, and no one could cross it until they filled it and repaired it.
Yeah.
Or even when Hastings Creek actually washed out because it had a backlog of so much ice and water that it just took the land bridge they had there out.
So it was like a dam behind it?
That it was just melting and melting. And since it's a pretty big creek, that it's just been like a big valley. So whenever that builds up, you know, people probably get nervous, especially the people people that live out at Cape. And they probably get a little nervous.
Yeah.
I do when I see that they put in like 3 culverts and not one big, or a bunch of big culverts and just, you know, one big one and a couple smaller ones.
Mm-hmm. Gosh. So I think we've covered almost everything we wanted to cover, but I wanted to give you the opportunity. So, you had said we hadn't talked about food preparation. Was there anything else that you think is really important to the changes that you're seeing and for your climate adaptation plan that you'd like to talk about?
Not that I can think of or bring out right now.
Okay. Did you have any further questions at all, Katie?
I don't think so. No.
I want to really thank you. I've learned so much. Thank you very much for coming in today. That's been wonderful. And we'll certainly give you a copy of the recording to help you with your planning.
No, thank you.
And thank you so much for being part of this.
Okay.